Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from antiwar.com. This is anti-war news for Friday, May 17th, 2024. All right, the first story at the top of antiwar.com today. Ukraine asks NATO to send troops for training. So the New York Times reported on Thursday that Ukrainian officials have asked NATO countries to send troops to Ukraine to help train 150,000 new recruits. The report said that NATO countries are inching closer to sending trainers, which, of course, would mark a huge escalation and risk a direct war with Russia. We know that there are a small number of NATO special operations forces in Ukraine. As of March 2023, so a little over a year ago, there was 97. But an open deployment to train a large number of Ukrainian troops would take things to another level. And so this is a big story. This New York Times story, the headline was actually about NATO considering sending trainers into Ukraine. But what I thought was more, you know, because we know that some NATO countries have been talking about this openly, what I thought was more significant was the fact that this report says Ukraine has asked for it, has requested NATO troops. As far as I understand, this is really the first that we know for sure that Ukraine is asking for a specific NATO troop deployment to train troops. You know, in the early days of the war, Zelensky was asking for the no-fly zone, which was asking for direct NATO intervention, and that would mean war with Russia. But here it looks like the Ukrainians are asking for NATO to deploy troops. And the U.S. and NATO were training Ukrainian troops inside Ukraine before Russia invaded in February 2022. Since then, the training has been held in Germany and other parts of Europe, but Kiev wants to shift it back inside Ukraine so the Ukrainian recruits can be quickly deployed to the front lines. So far, the U.S. has not agreed to the request, but it appears that Washington is considering it. The New York Times cited a U.S. official who said one possibility could be to train Ukrainian troops in Lviv, which is a city in western Ukraine near the Polish border. So a U.S. official is saying, yeah, maybe that's something that we could do. And Russia has bombed this area, this part of Ukraine, throughout the war. They've hit targets pretty far west, including strikes in Lviv just a few weeks ago that targeted energy infrastructure. In comments on Thursday, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Charles Q. Brown, said that a NATO training deployment was an inevitability, but appeared to rule it out for now. He told reporters, quote, "We'll get there eventually over time," end quote. So that is really something to see the top officer in the U.S. military say. Yeah, we'll eventually, we'll have troops in Ukraine eventually. But he said right now it would put a bunch of NATO trainers at risk. And he said that Ukraine would have to choose whether to use air defenses to protect them or infrastructure near the front line. So he's saying that, acknowledging that if NATO does this, Russia's probably going to target these NATO troops. And this is, we've seen other NATO countries, France, of course, expressing interest in sending troops to Ukraine, despite the risk of direct war with Russia. And the three countries that I've seen like that seem to be seriously discussing this is France and Lithuania. Their prime minister just said that they're ready to do it if NATO goes ahead with some sort of training mission. And Estonia, they're discussing kind of another plan that would involve sending troops to sort of relieve Ukrainian soldiers of their duties in Western Ukraine so they can go fight on the front lines. And that's kind of another level because they're like directly participating in the war effort. I mean, training would be the same thing, I guess, but it's just very concerning to see that Ukraine apparently has made the request and they're not just saying, no, we can't do it. You know, when they were asking for the no-fly zone, the U.S. response was, no, absolutely not. That means war with Russia, World War III. Now they're asking for troops. And it doesn't look like they're saying no. I mean, Brown, this is public. You know, this is the, again, the highest ranking U.S. officer in the U.S. military saying, yeah, we'll get there eventually. Not just saying, no, that's World War III. We're not doing that. So I'm curious. I might try asking some questions myself. What, you know, the State Department will say, what the White House will say, if reporters follow up on this, like, you know, it's just, it's really concerning, and just the risk of escalation in Ukraine. I know much of the attention has been focused on Gaza for good reason, but things have really been escalating in Ukraine. You know, they don't want to give this proxy war up, even though there's clearly no chance of them winning as defined by Zelensky's goals. You know, they want to keep this thing going. You know, in the West, in the U.S., I think the goal is to just keep this war going, not necessarily win. You know, they don't want Ukrainian front lines to completely collapse. All right, so the next one here, Zelensky blames the world for Russia's Kharkiv offensive. So Zelensky visited Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv Oblast on Thursday and blamed the Russian offensive in the region on the world for not sending enough weapons. So he referred to delays in Congress passing a $61 billion Ukraine aid package, which was authorized last month. He said, quote, brigades are not totally equipped because of the package, which we waited through for 8 months, end quote. So he's specifically referring to the U.S. aid. And he was asked if what's happening now in Kharkiv is America's fault. Zelensky replied, it's the world's fault. They gave the opportunity for Putin to occupy, but now the world can help, end quote. And if you look at, I put a map in here from South Front of the fighting in Kharkiv, and Russia continues to make some gains here. And this is the main village, the Vovshansk, the larger village that they are fighting around, and Russia is making some gains there. And so the situation is not good for Ukraine. And Zelensky is claiming that if he just had two more U.S.-made Patriot air defense systems, that Ukrainian forces would be able to hold onto this region. I don't see how that is the case, but that's what he's saying. And while you have Zelensky here blaming the Russian success on weapons shortages, Ukrainian soldiers have said that there were no proper fortifications in the area, despite intelligence that showed Russia was amassing troops on the border here. There was a clear indication that they were planning some sort of incursion. And I quoted the Ukrainian soldier, a commander of a Ukrainian special reconnaissance unit, Yaroslavsky. He said, quote, there was no first line of defense. We saw it. The Russians just walked in. They just walked in without any mind field. Either it was an act of negligence or corruption. It wasn't a failure. It was a betrayal, end quote. And there was a Ukrainian anti-corruption activist. She wrote in Ukrainska Pravda that it looked like, by her trying to track the money, that there was money earmarked to be spent on building fortifications in Kharkiv, but it looks like it was stolen through shell companies. The article's in Ukrainian, but you know, you could do the Google Translate, and it says, she's saying these companies just popped up when this contract was made, and they got all this money, and then there was no real fortifications in this area. And you see the Russians walked right in, according to that Ukrainian commander. All right, so the next one here, Germany deports 7 Ukrainian soldiers for wearing Nazi symbols. So I thought this was a nice little companion piece for the training. And this is from Ynet, the Israeli site. Man, this site is like the worst with ads. I don't even know where the story went. I really need to just turn an ad blocker on for when I do this show. Anyway, so again, I just thought this was kind of just went well with the first story about the U.S. training Ukrainians. So Germany deported 7 Ukrainian soldiers who were training in the country on Thursday over their use of Nazi symbols, Kommersant reported. According to the report, the training of the Ukrainian soldiers was immediately halted after some were found to be wearing Nazi symbols. German authorities announced that all Ukrainian military personnel arriving for training in Germany will now be explicitly instructed that it is prohibited to display Nazi symbols. The use of Nazi symbols is banned in both Germany and Russia. Russia has condemned the Western support for Ukraine, including the training of its soldiers. So again, you know, it's interesting that you see the Nazi symbols on, you know, there's a few times I know, like NATO, I know in one case, I remember they tweeted a picture of a Ukrainian soldier. It was a woman and she had the, oh man, I forget, I'm blanking on the name of it, but it was one of the Nazi symbols, that it's not a swastika, but there's other symbols that you see the Ukrainian soldiers have. And then they deleted it, of course. And that happened like a few times. So it's just, you know, kind of funny. All right. Everybody's an anti-Semite except for the people wearing the Nazi symbols, apparently. But anyway, all right. The next one here, Gallant says that Israeli operations in Rafah will intensify. So Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant announced Thursday that Israel will send more troops to Rafah and intensify operations in the city, where around 1 million civilians are sheltering. So Gallant said, quote, "This operation will continue with additional forces that will enter the area. Several tunnels in the area have been destroyed by our forces, and more tunnels will be destroyed soon. This operation will intensify, and Hamas is not an organization that can regenerate itself now," end quote. So the announcement from Gallant comes despite the U.S. claiming, at least, that they are opposed to major Israeli operation in Rafah. Biden threatened to withhold certain types of weapons from Israel if it launches a major assault, but so far he has not imposed any consequences. Instead, his administration is moving forward with a $1 billion arms package for Israel. So according to aid groups, about 450,000 people have fled Rafah since Israel launched its operation. Before Israel captured the Rafah border crossing last week, it was estimated that about 1.4 million civilians were sheltering in the city, which has a pre-war population of 275,000. The Israeli operation has cut off the vital Rafah border crossing, adding to the starvation blockade on the strip. So Israel has also escalated in northern Gaza in areas where it previously claimed to have defeated Hamas. And over the past week, we've seen Israel ramping up airstrikes and artillery strikes across Gaza, killing scores of Palestinians. The Israeli military has faced some pretty fierce resistance on the ground in both Rafah and in the Jabalia refugee camp. At least one Israeli soldier has been killed in Rafah. The Israeli military said Thursday that five IDF soldiers were killed by friendly fire in Jabalia. They said that an Israeli tank shelled a building where there were some Israeli soldiers standing. I saw one video that Hamas put out. I wasn't sure if it was in the north, of them hitting an Israeli tank, but with a RPG of some sort. So anyway, that the escalations continue here. And the next one, South Africa asks the ICJ to order Israel to halt Rafah offensive. So this article is from Middle East Eye. So on Thursday, South Africa asked the International Court of Justice to order Israel to halt its offensive on Rafah and argued that the assault posed a risk to the very survival of Palestinians in Gaza. So South Africa's ambassador to the Netherlands asked the court in his opening remarks to do what it can to stop the genocide. He added that South Africa's fourth submission to the court was triggered not only by the assault on Rafah, but by an intensification of the Israeli assault across Gaza in the last few days. Basically, what South Africa is saying is that these measures that they've already ordered, they didn't explicitly call for a ceasefire. They told Israel to stop, you know, killing a lot of Palestinians, basically. I forget the exact wording, but obviously that hasn't influenced Israel. They haven't listened to the court. So now they're asking specifically for them to order an end to the Rafah assault. And this was on Thursday that South Africa made its case. Then Friday, Israel is going to give its defense, and then we'll see what the court decides. All right, so the next one here, satellite images show widening destruction in Rafah amid invasion. So this is from the New York Times, and it just shows the destruction in Rafah. Again, this idea that this is some sort of small, limited operation, I is just, you know, you look at this satellite images, they've demolished and destroyed a lot of buildings. I think they, you know, both through bombing and using the bulldozers and everything. And this is in eastern Rafah. So this is where they've been pushing into, apparently Israeli tanks have been pushing into residential areas here. This is where they ordered most of the people to evacuate from. And you can just really see there's a lot of damage here. All right. So the next one here, Egypt deploys military convoys to Gaza border as tensions flare. This is another article from Middle East Eye. I haven't really covered much of the, like, the tensions between Egypt and Israel, but Israel capturing that side of the Rafah border crossing is technically in violation of the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. They're not supposed to control the Philadelphia corridor, which is what they call that part of Gaza that borders Egypt. And they definitely did give Egypt some sort of heads up that they were going to do it. And there was that report from Haaretz that apparently they made some deal that they'll take it over and then a private American company will take over the border crossing, but I haven't seen much more on that. But anyway, so Egypt deployed additional armored personnel carriers and soldiers to its border with Gaza in northeastern Sinai this week, an Egyptian rights group said, in a sign of further deteriorating ties between Cairo and Israel. 15 armored personnel carriers mounted with combat gear were spotted by Sinai residents of Sheikh Zuwaid traveling toward Egypt's border with Gaza on Wednesday evening. There's another convoy of armored vehicles. Basically, they're beefing up their military on the border there. And there's all these reports about Israel and Egypt, like, blaming each other for the Rafah border crossing still being closed. I know it seemed like almost that Egypt agreed to this Israeli operation as long as they captured the Rafah border crossing initially, because they were worried about if Hamas controlled it or whoever, they were worried about them just letting Palestinians into Egyptian territory. But you know, Israel's got it closed off. So I think while there is tensions at some level, Egypt is still like coordinating with Israel to some extent. All right. So the next one here, the House approves a bill to force bomb shipment to Israel. So the House on Thursday passed a bill designed to force President Biden to lift a pause on a shipment of 2,000-pound bombs to Israel. The legislation is considered symbolic since President Biden has threatened a veto, and it's not expected to be brought up for a vote in the Senate. What it's seen as is an effort by Republicans to show that the GOP is the staunchly pro-Israel party. And I think with the election coming up in November, that's what Trump and Republicans are going to be running on, how pro-Israel they are. So the bill passed in a vote of 224 to 187 with 16 Democrats and nearly every Republican in the House voting yes. Only three Republicans were opposed. Representatives Thomas Massey of Kentucky, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, and Warren Davidson of Ohio. So the bill would prohibit any arms shipments to Israel from being paused, limited, or canceled, and it would require the prompt delivery of weapons to Israel. The legislation is also designed to withhold funding to the Pentagon, the State Department, and the National Security Council. And the reason for that is so salaries will not be paid to any U.S. official involved in limiting military aid to Israel until the obligations under this bill are fulfilled. I mean, it's just they would cut off funding to the U.S. government if over a bomb shipment being paused, when Biden has shipped over tens of thousands of these bombs since October 7th, approved over 100 arms deals, given Israel everything that they want. Pause one bomb shipment. They're trying to push through this bill to cut their salaries. They don't want the U.S. officials to be paid. And, you know, this is the Republican reaction that we're seeing, even though, as I've been covering, this isn't what Biden has done here, really isn't much. Israel has what they need to escalate in Rafah. And he still hasn't done anything, even though they continue to escalate in Rafah and their, you know, the new weapons package. They're promising that Israel is going to get all that money, all that military aid that they just approved. So I put in a tweet here from Michael Tracy because I liked the way he put it. He listed the Democrats who voted yes, because the bill also condemned Biden. So I'm just going to read Tracy's tweet because he kind of sums up there what they're doing here. The following House Democrats are so fanatically pro-Israel above all other apparent loyalties that they just voted with 208 House Republicans to denounce Biden and literally defund the White House National Security Council unless and until Biden agrees to facilitate the provision of completely unconditional aid to Israel. And it's, again, 16 Democrats. Of course, Richie Torres is on there. When I think of super pro-Israel Democrats in the House, I think of Richie Torres. Matt Cartwright, Angie Craig, Henry Kuehler, Don Davis. I don't know most of these people, but they are very, very pro-Israel. All right. But again, that bill is not really expected to go anywhere, but it just goes to show. And I think we're going to see a lot of votes, you know, with Johnson leading the House. We're going to see like just more and more symbolic legislation to show how much the Republicans love Israel. All right, so the next one here, human rights researchers conclude that Israel is committing genocide. So this is from Kyle Anzalone at the Libertarian Institute. It says a group of researchers at top universities concluded Israel was committing a genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza. Since October 7th, Israeli forces have destroyed most of the homes in Gaza, leaving 5% of the population dead or injured. The University Network for Human Rights Study, led by a group of researchers from Boston University, Cornell Law School, the University of Pretoria, and Yale Law School, published a report on Wednesday that found Israel's actions in Gaza violate the Genocide Convention. So this study says, quote, after reviewing the facts established by independent human rights monitors, journalists, and United Nations agencies, we conclude that Israel's actions in and regarding Gaza since October 7th violate the Genocide Convention. Specifically, Israel has committed genocidal acts of killing, causing serious harm to, and inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of Palestinians in Gaza, a protected group that forms a substantial part of the Palestinian population, end quote. All right, so the next one here, Ilan Pappe, interrogated for U.S. intel, interrogated by U.S. intelligence upon arrival in the U.S. So prominent Israeli academic Ilan Pappe, who I'm sure many of you know, he says that he was interrogated by the Department of Homeland Security after arriving in the U.S. on Monday. Arriving at Detroit Airport, the academic, known for his stridently anti-Zionist views and research, said that he was subjected to 2 hours of questioning. He's Israeli. Among the questions, he was asked whether he was a Hamas supporter and whether he regarded the Israeli assault on Gaza as a genocide. He wrote on Facebook, quote, the two-man team were not abusive or rude, I should say, but their questions were really out of this world. They had long phone conversation with someone, and after copying everything on my phone, allowed me to enter, end quote. A number of pro-Palestinian campaigners have warned of increasing pressure being applied by state authorities in the U.S. and Europe against prominent opponents of Israel's war in Gaza. Pape also cited the treatment of British Palestinian doctor and rector of Glasgow University, Ghassan Abu Sitta, who on the 12th of April was detained at an airport in Germany and refused entry into the country. I believe he was eventually, yeah, the ban was overturned, but still starting to see this. And I mean, this is the U.S. An Israeli gets interrogated like that for 2 hours, asking if he thinks Israel's committing a genocide. You know, that's very, very concerning stuff. And I'm sure that similar things have probably happened to Arabs or, you know, Palestinians traveling. We just don't hear about it. All right, so the next one here, Israeli strike kills two near a Lebanon funeral procession. So an Israeli drone fired on a car near the funeral procession for Hussein Ibrahim Maki, a Hezbollah commander who was killed earlier this week. The drone strike killed at least two people. Details are still emerging, but both slain were young men, and the rescue agency that arrived on the scene said one may have been a member of Hezbollah. The strike on the car took place in Kana near the city of Tyre, which was the site of the strike that killed Maki. So we actually have seen this before, Israel killing a Hezbollah commander or something and then targeting people around the funeral, because they usually do the funerals a lot of times the next day, and they have big public funeral processions and they get attacked. Repeating a pattern we've seen from Israel, and goes to show again, I feel like it's every day that I cover strikes, you know, on either side of the border. All right. So the next one here, Xi agrees to deepen China-Russia military ties. So Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping held talks in Beijing on Thursday and agreed to deepen military cooperation as China has brushed off U.S. warnings about its relationship with Russia. So Russia and China released a joint statement that said they would further deepen military cooperation by expanding joint military exercises, increasing air and sea patrols, and strengthening their coordination under bilateral frameworks. Xi also renewed a call for a peace deal to end the war in Ukraine. So he said after the talks with Putin, quote, "Both sides agree that a political settlement of the Ukraine crisis is the correct direction. China's position on this issue has been consistent and clear, including the respect for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of all countries and the legitimate security concerns of all parties," end quote. So China has consistently called for peace talks throughout the war, while you have the U.S. and most NATO countries opposing that idea, opposing and discouraging diplomacy and flooding weapons into Ukraine. Despite that, the U.S. and NATO are accusing China of fueling the conflict by increasing trade with Russia, which is a natural thing for both Russia and China to do. They've been facing similar pressure from the West. Any idiot could have told you a few years ago that they were going to increase trade like this, and they, you know, even before the Ukraine war. And they have, you know, it's the obvious thing for them to do. And of course, the U.S. is freaking out about it and just making threats and warnings that China's not going to listen to. Again, like, if you know anything about China, they're not just going to, you can't just threaten them and say, don't do that, China. It, you know, in this context, it's just, I can't believe these people think that they're diplomats, like Blinken, that make these threats. You know, he was in China and threatened them with sanctions over their trade with their neighbor. And, you know, they're accusing China of providing material support to the Russian military because they export things like semiconductors and certain types of minerals and things and other natural resources. You know, there's the technological stuff, of course, but also natural resources. That's another thing that they're unhappy that China is exporting to Russia, and they're unhappy that China is buying lots of Russian oil. So while Putin was in Beijing, actually, the Pentagon issued another warning to China over its relationship with Russia. Eli Ratner, who is an assistant secretary of defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs, he's a huge China hawk. He spoke with a Chinese military official, and according to the Pentagon, raised, quote, "serious concern over the People's Republic of China's support for Russia's defense industrial base that enables Russia's war in Ukraine," end quote. So they're not going to learn their lesson. And you see this, you know, like the U.S. tries to dictate to these countries what to do, like with Niger. You know, if they really wanted to stay in Niger, you shouldn't have done that. and they told them, they threatened them with sanctions, and then they kicked the U.S. out, or they're trying to kick the U.S. out. All right, so that's it for the news for today. Please go check out our viewpoints. One from Jeffrey S. K. FBI documents allege Japan used germ warfare in attack on U.S. and Canada. One from James Carden, the dignity deficit of rocking out in Kiev. One from Joseph Solis Mullen, the continuing farce of the U.S. tariff war. One from Ramsey Baroud, why Gaza journalists are the best in the world. And our spotlight is from Ryan McMackin, war hysteria fuels new attacks on free speech. So that's it for this week. You could help us out with our fundraiser, which has been going well. So I appreciate everyone who has helped out and pitched in, and all of our supporters and all the listeners of this show and our readers. in general. But antiwar.com/donate for that. Also, follow us on Instagram. The posts are looking really great over there. There's like the algorithm is working against us. Apparently they don't put any sort of like political posts in front of people anymore. Follow us on X, follow me on X, my personal account, and like and subscribe, comment. I appreciate all the comments and everything. I hope everyone has a good weekend. I'll be back in a few days. Thanks for listening.